OK, bienvenue, troisième épisode de Spectre avec JC. Aujourd'hui, on a Andrew Liberio. Andrew a travaillé dans les restaurants pendant plusieurs années, des Notorious Restaurants. Puis récemment, il a lancé un organisme à but non lucratif en français, right?
Mm-hmm.
La fourmi verte. Tu peux dire allô to the people.
Bonjour tout le monde, je suis très content d'être ici aujourd'hui.
Cheers. Donc la fourmi verte. En fait, je sais même plus c'est quoi, parce que tu l'as parti, ça fait combien d'années?
C'était
en janvier 2017.
Yeah, we're doing it in English.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So how long...
I just got really nervous.
How long ago did you start? You did that speech in French. That was good. Was
yeah.
It in... yeah, it was
yeah,
nice,
yeah.
Man. But you prepared a lot, right?
I prepared, yeah, and I read it over and over again. Your
but
sister made
do you
me
think
memorize.
There's going to be a point in your life when you're going to be comfortable? Because you're pretty good. You're obviously better than you think.
I'm okay, but there's some contexts where I'm better than others. Like... Now with this nonprofit thing, I always basically just say the same thing. So
right.
It's like the same words and stuff.
Right, right, right.
So like when I speak French in that context, I'm pretty good. But in
because you did it so often, right?
Yeah. But there's some contexts, like other contexts I'm in. Like if I'm talking about hockey, let's say in French.
Then it's good
like,
or
no? No, it's not. It's not good. Okay. I don't know the terms. I don't know. Like,
right, right, right. Same with food? No, food you did in
French. Food I'm okay, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, so let's start with the fourmi verte. How long ago did you start it?
We founded in January 2017. So it's been, I guess, like 2 years now.
And it changed a lot, huh?
Yeah.
That's why I was skeptical on describing it, because I don't even know what they do anymore. So you say how you started out. How
I don't know
when
either.
You started, like what you imagined it would be.
I think probably I was too ambitious when I started it, but the idea was to create a nonprofit that hopefully to eventually become a charity, which we didn't end up doing for a variety of reasons, but it was just to create a nonprofit. We didn't intend really on making money with this thing. We just kind of wanted to try and fix some problems.
Right.
So we wanted to use like transformation as a means of reducing food waste.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I don't even think we mentioned it. So what is it like at the
okay.
core?
Yeah. So it's a nonprofit that tries to reduce food waste in Montreal through various projects that we undertake. Like, that's kind of how I explain it now.
Right. Because that's how you change it so much through over the 2 years,
yeah.
Right? Through various projects.
So the methods that we've been using to try and reduce food waste have changed. But the goal in itself is to reduce food waste in Montreal. Like, that's pretty much what the
yeah.
goal is. That's never changed.
Okay. And how, when did the idea came up? Was it like a long time ago or?
I guess in the second half of 2016 when I was working at Orange Rouge.
Yeah.
But even just generally in the time that I was working in restaurants, I would always think about wasting food and how every restaurant says, we don't waste anything, we use anything, and it's completely not true at all.
Right.
They just like to say that. And then they'll make a powder with like skin of something, right? And then they'll say, oh, we use the skin of the... But you throw out 90% of the skin anyway, right? Because you just need a little powder. So you could put the powder of the skin of the potato on your plate.
So it's like
and
a
then you say,
almost a marketing...
Yes,
right?
Because it's trendy.
Yeah.
So
it's like
it's not
a
actually
social
to reduce...
responsibility for companies, right? They use it.
Yeah. It's like they're trying to attach themselves onto whatever... Whatever's trendy, that's why everyone has gluten-free.
Because us millennials fucking love that shit.
That we love, yeah. And
no
then we're going
to
support that company.
And so what, like, can you just lay out, like, your path towards Orange Rouge? Because I know there's this fancy restaurant in the Denmark, but that's all I know. You did some others, right?
Yeah, I was at Toqué in Montreal for...
Is that where you started?
No. I started at an Italian restaurant in Old Montreal. It was called Graziella.
Okay. How old were you?
I was 17. I was probably 18 at that time. I went to cooking school when I was 17, and I graduated when I was 18, so I was 18 when I started.
But you still did CJEP though, right?
No.
Oh, so you went...
I did CJEP when I was 23, I started, 22.
Ah, you
so
had
I
to
went
do,
straight after
did
high
it?
School. I didn't have... Why? Okay,
no.
I'll start back from the beginning because it's complicated.
Okay, cause, but when you, once you're 21, you don't have to do it, right? Past
no, you can apply as like a mature student, but it's basically the same thing.
Okay. Wait, but let's just start with...
So I went to cooking school straight after high school.
Right.
Then I worked in restaurants. Like I was at Graziella for, I don't know, 6 months, a year.
What were you doing there?
I was just a cook, and then I worked my way up a little bit. It was a small kitchen.
So. That's the only way to, even like school, cooking school, no cooking school, you have to go there, right?
Yeah. You need to, the majority of stuff you learn in the real world of being a cook is like on the job. It's not in cooking school.
What the fuck do you learn in cooking school?
In cooking school, like you learn cutting. Cutting techniques, all the sauces, a little bit of history, a little bit of, I guess, how to run a restaurant. Or doing food cost and those kinds of things.
And then for how long?
My course was like 9 months.
Oh, so it's not too long.
It's not too long, but they're longer here. Here they're like 2 years. So me, I went to Ottawa to do. It was at Cordon Bleu in Ottawa.
Cordon Bleu, that's a brand. That's a food brand.
Yeah. Well, it's like a famous cooking school.
Okay.
It's like a well-known international cooking school. They have like... I think 6 or 7 around the world. The original ones in French. Fuck. It's where what's her name went. Julia Child.
Famous people.
Yeah, Julia Child.
Okay.
Right.
I don't know that person. I don't know famous people.
The French girl. Julie. No, she's not French, but she's American, and she went there. She wanted to be a chef. She was like one of the first chefs, like women chefs.
Okay. Good for
her. It was a big deal.
Right.
Because it was like for men, you know.
Was it like officially for men, or just like they wouldn't get in?
Well, the high-end cooking, when was it? It was, I guess, mid-1900s.
They made a fucking movie on
yeah,
her.
Yeah, they made a movie on her.
Ah, yes. It's Meryl Streep.
It's Meryl Streep, the actor. Yeah, that plays her.
Wow, Julia Child. I can't believe I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What year was that first woman cooking?
1900s, like 50-ish. I don't know. I'm not too sure. Yeah, so that's where Cordon Bleu became famous from, because it was the original ones from France. They only had one, yeah. And then they expanded kind of all over the world. They have one in Ottawa, so I went there. Okay. But it's like that school has a lot of history for being like the best like cooking school.
Okay,
because it's French, it's classic French,
right?
Which is also like where all of the base of real cooking, it all kind of comes back from French, because they were the ones who kind of formalized high-end cuisine.
Even across Europe, they were like...
I mean, it's like saying how today's music comes from blues or whatever, right? Like, it's the...
Is it a proper comparison?
I think so.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But like, are you saying...
Cause no, but you know how like rock and roll and whatever, let's say the whole yeah. rock and roll, whatever... path came from blues, right?
Okay. That's a fact. I didn't know that.
I think so.
Okay.
They all say like Led Zeppelin and stuff, right?
Oh yeah, I didn't tell you at the beginning. Everything you say will be used against
checked,
you forever.
Checked. Right.
Anytime. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I get hate mail on Twitter. Yeah. I'm on Twitter actually.
Don't say your fucking...
I don't know my name. I think it's just stuff, right? Andrew Liberio.
Why would you say that?
Because I have no followers.
No, but wait. So you're saying that, right? But even within Europe, like back then, France was like above kind of everyone else in terms of cooking?
The reason is because they really formalized it. Like Escoffier. Have you heard of Escoffier?
No.
He's like the guy who like wrote everything down in a book. It's called Auguste Escoffier, Guide de Culinaire.
Okay.
He wrote back it all down. It was like early 1900s.
Okay.
He said, this is high-end cuisine. Everything was defined.
And no one could say anything because no one had anything to...
Because no one had anything. Like, people had their... whatever, their culture and the food that came with their culture. You know, whatever, Spanish, yeah. Italian. But none of it was formalized. So the French were really the first ones to, like, formalize high-end cuisine.
Okay.
And then formalizing high-end cuisine became a thing. So then, like, kind of the Italians did it. And then
or just formalizing Spanish cuisine data. as a
yeah.
like, just concept, right?
Yeah.
Huh. So before that, like everyone was just fucking winging it all the time.
I think there was not really high end cuisine. Like cooking was, I mean, like in
just to stay alive, kind of.
Yeah, I mean it came out of necessity, and that's why we see all these classic dishes and stuff. They all come out of like. Using the bones, right? Or using like this part of the animal that you would never think of using, and or preserving things because you need to make it last throughout the winter, right? And then these turn into things that are like delicious, but it came out of necessity in the first place. It just didn't come out of someone saying like, yeah, using every single part, preserving whatever.
Okay. And then the cordon bleu thing, it's good just because it's half the time. Because you're saying back in Quebec, it's 2 years.
Yeah, it's like two years, I think.
I mean, learning how to fuck it. And I guess they go deeper maybe, but like...
They go deeper and they do more like...
More sauces?
They do more on managing restaurant and stuff. And they have different programs also.
Is that at ITHQ?
Yeah.
Okay.
But ITHQ, they have like different programs. I don't know too much about it, but like they have like different like...
Yeah, because they kind of brand themselves as a university. Or maybe it is a university or it's becoming or something.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
And so that was really like... You learn how to cook it, and that's it. You learn French cuisine. It's intensive. It was like split up in three parts. There's exams, and they're hard.
Like,
people fail, and it's expensive.
Like, fuck. And like long days, and like mentally exhausting.
Yeah, mentally exhausted. For me, I guess I was like 17. So
people were older.
Most people were older.
How'd you get in? Motivation.
If you can pay, you
get in. Okay.
Yeah. Fair enough. They're good. There was a lot of different people. There were some older people, a few like older moms, like mid-40s.
Yeah. Who, not professional.
Not professional, but they wanted to do it, I guess.
Right.
But most were like men between, or men and women, but a bit more men between the age of like 22 and 30, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, sort that's nice to meet just different people, different stuff to talk about.
Yeah. So that was good. Then I worked in a bunch of restaurants. Then I worked at Tokay for a few years.
Years? How?
A few years. 2 years. Well, between Tokay and the Brasserie.
You're my age, right? You're not that
old. I'm 26.
You talk like you did fucking like a few years at the Italian restaurant, then a few years there.
Yeah, Italian restaurant wasn't a few years. Like Italian restaurant, then it was like maybe 6 months. Then I did a French restaurant for, I think, a year.
And how did you land at Tokay?
I applied for it when I was at a French restaurant.
You just applied? They like the background?
I just applied, basically. Then they called me back and said, like, no, you didn't get it. And then I called them back and I'm like, okay, like, I really want to work here. So, like, how about, like, you just hire me? And they're like, okay, fine. Like, you do a tryout. And then I did a tryout and then I got it.
Okay.
So, but I started at the Brasserie. I didn't start at Tokay.
You hung up. You called back right away?
He called me. I was like busy. I was working at the restaurant and I was like, okay, whatever. And then I think I thought about it. I was really disappointed. I called him back the next day and I was like, why don't you just give me a tryout? And then if you like me, and then whenever you have an open position, like you can just hire me. Because the way they hire in restaurants is so like, it's like that basically. Like a lot of people, you get in because you know someone.
Right.
Like Min will ask me when he needs cooks, right? He'll just text me like, hey, do you have cooks?
Okay.
Like there's no like apply. Like if someone comes to a restaurant and like gives their CV and then just leaves, like gives their CV to the hostess or whatever.
Right.
You're gone. You're not getting a job. Mm-hmm. Like you need to get in somehow from get a word through to the chef or meet him or just give your CV personally to him. That'll make a big difference.
Why? Give your CV at the reception at the fucking hostess.
Yeah, and then run away.
Yeah. But as it, I feel like I heard like recently there's been a kind of a shortage, right? Cooks? Hasn't it been always that?
Well, in the past like 10 years, 15 years, I guess, since I've been in the industry.
Cool.
it's good gone timing. Down. Yeah, there is a lot of demand.
But then wouldn't that be, like, wouldn't that make the salaries go up a bit? Usually? Free market? I don't know.
Yeah, it should, but they don't go up. I guess, I mean, I know more in Montreal. I guess I understand a little bit more the reasons for it. Since there's so many restaurants, no one's going to... If a restaurant raises their salary, they're going to close because they can't afford salaries.
Margins are too thin?
Margins are super thin in restaurants.
People keep complaining about the prices in a restaurant, though. Maybe that's just my friends are cheap.
I mean, labor continues to increase in Quebec, right?
Right. $12 recently.
Yeah, now it's 12 and it's going, I think, back up to $12.50 or something. They've been
this year.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
They have a plan that they set in place since I guess like a year and a half ago or something. It was like $11.25, and then it jumped to like
that was the biggest jump ever, I think.
Yeah.
Up to 12.
Yeah.
And then the goal is 15. I heard.
I think the goal is 15.
But over a few years.
Over a few years. But so, they're jumping really quickly. Like they're jumping faster than.
But so that's kind of simple. So like it's a pretty much a guarantee that restaurant prices are like will go up in the next few years. just to stay afloat.
Pretty much, yeah. They're going to have to with salary because labor cost in a restaurant is like around 30-40%. So like when you pay $10 for a salad, it's like between $4 and $6 is going towards paying like the cook, the dishwasher, the waiter, the hostess.
People.
There's a lot of people.
And then there's like the rent.
Bring your salad.
And then there's the
rent food. Is about 10%. Food is between 20-30% depending on the restaurant.
So that leaves 5. Did I get the math right?
You're the math guy. Well, then, yeah, I'm the math
guy. But like, it's like 5 to 10%, I guess?
It's like 40, 50, 60, 70, 80. And then you have, you know.
Protection?
Yeah, insurance, taxes, yeah. All that stuff, which is another like 10 to 15%. Usually, like, profit is between 5 and 10% if you're like good. But often for the first few years, it's negative.
And like, even the fanciest one, right?
Yeah. Even the fanciest ones, like Toki opened the brasserie and other restaurants do this too because the margins are higher. That's the square at the Place des Arts.
Right. And so you're saying the margins are thinner
when you go in higher end restaurants? Yeah, margins are thinner.
That's fucking crazy. Because of that's the food, right? The food cost goes way up.
Labor also almost like when you go in like a diner, you have like maybe one or two waitresses, right? Mm-hmm. For like how many people?
Yeah.
Right? But at Toki, you have one waiter has maybe like 2-3 tables, right?
Right.
And then you have the hostess or two hostess. Then you have the barman. Then
and
the
more
wine
people
guy.
In the kitchen as well?
Yeah, the kitchen is like 20, 30, 20 people. For night service, 20 people.
How many people seat in the restaurant?
I think 50-ish.
And so that's like 1 to 5? That'd be interesting, like a ratio.
At Noma, it was...
That's where I was going to go.
Okay, so Noma, there was 50 cooks for 50 people.
That is fucking nuts.
Yeah. Because, honestly, some plates, to plate it, takes 8 minutes. Like, one person, it'll take 8 minutes to do it, to plate it. So when the chef says, okay, we'll go on table, whatever. Oh, okay, so I'm going to make this beet thing. Okay, so I take a bowl, start making the beet thing, and it's like, it takes 8 minutes.
Shit.
Can we swear?
Yeah, dude, you can do whatever the fuck you want.
Okay, then he's like, where's my fucking beat thing?
And, swear in kitchens?
No, never.
Wait, but so you went from Toki to Noma? I assume that seeing Toki on your resume, that was what
you went. Yeah, Toki, Cordon Bleu. And you had to write like a sort of letter of intent sort of thing. And... I really explained like in detail why I really wanted to work there and learn from that kind of restaurant.
Are you a good writer? Like
I'm okay.
Like your level of English is like
it's like fine. It's like slightly above average sort of thing.
Right.
Like it's not like amazing, but it's like good.
And I guess we can assume that the guys that are going to read it are not
right. They were
amazing either, right?
No, but I just really took a lot of time. Like I read through it a lot of time, and I made sure I really was got my point across about like really why I wanted to work there.
You don't give it to other people to read and proofread?
No,
never really.
Not really. Not not that kind of thing. No, because then they're gonna give me comments, and I won't
and you
really,
don't want to hear listen to them. Well, I guess if it works, it works. Because for me, man, I have to have like 10 people read it.
Really?
Because I just make too many mistakes, like grammar. And orthographe, okay, that's grammar?
Yeah.
Orthographe. Just like how words are spelled. And conjugaison, you know, French. It's even
worse.
I think
French.
English is better.
Though. Yeah. No, in French, I'll have someone read it over you.
But even then, I applied to that thing. What was it? That conference in New York. And I sent it to a friend of mine. She's like a writer, right? And I sent it to her. And I'm like, so what do you think? You can just like proofread it?
Mm.
And she was like, yeah, I think your points are good. Let me just like rearrange the paragraphs. She changed the whole thing. She
really?
Just sent it back. And I was like, I can't really change it again, right?
No.
So I just sent it and
so
I got
much
in.
Yeah.
But so then I That's assume good. So many people do that though.
Yeah.
Because I mean, no one ever is going to catch you. And...
It's like when I applied for funding, government funding for my nonprofit.
Yeah.
And any funding I applied for, I didn't get it. One, it was in French. It was in French. So my writing is not as good in French.
Right.
But I read a guy that I kind of like would work with from another organization, and him, he would get any funding he applied for, he got it. And the way he wrote, he would like study because they'll give you a document that says like, this is this kind of things that we're looking for.
Right. Like bullet points.
Yeah. And he'll take exactly those things and kind of twist
embed
it in a way
it. Yeah.
And show how every aspect of his project is like relates to those bullet points, and so they have basically no choice but to accept his project. And me, I'm like very ambitious,
you think too much,
creative.
Right?
Yeah. I'm like, oh, the project can be so good. We're gonna have this and this.
Yeah.
And then reject.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm kind of the same. But it's hard to like just like, because I feel like it's so fucking boring, an application letter that just answers those 10 bullet points.
Yeah, and it's very basic general things.
And it's kind of dumb because, but it's like you said, they can't not accept it if you meet the criteria, because the criteria are the criteria. But I feel like it's kind of a generational thing, because I feel like in class, they give a project, and it actually happened to me. They give a project, there's like exactly those 10 bullet points, right?
Yeah.
And people expect to get full marks if they just meet those 10 criteria. But to me, if you meet all of them, it's like 80, 90, maybe.
Yeah.
But is real life like that? I don't know, because I haven't left school. Because I feel like it's just like, it's going to get people confused, because they're going to get into real life. In real life, if you just do whatever everyone else is doing, you're not going to get a full mark. I was with a girl in my project, and that was it. And she was like arguing with the teacher, why didn't we get 100?
Because we just like,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we got those 5 things. And I was next to her, and she was looking at me like, huh? And I was like, not really, man. I think 90 is way even better than I expected.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, but for those kind of things, that's like governmental. So yes, I feel like they annoying. Probably cannot, just like you said, they can't not
they
accept
need
you.
To, they need to have like justification like on why they're giving funding.
Because if people complain, they're going to fucking sue them. But you still ended up getting some, or you get your...
No, I got nothing. Read?
Man, you
I got nothing.
Why don't you fucking add that? That you
now
should
I just don't it. Ask anymore. I'm scared of getting rejected.
You don't have... You don't have any French-speaking friends that are good?
Yeah.
Me, forget it.
Antoine, it's also the criteria it. I don't like. Because what I was doing also was... I have a lot of projects like that I'd like to do, but I have no money for. So
through La Fourmi Verte, all those projects?
Yeah, for the most part. So, but I can't really do them, so I don't have funding. So I go look for funding, and then each kind of funding request has specific criteria. So then I have to like adjust the project, like so that it meets with the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
But then it changes my project,
right?
A lot,
yeah. Because so they give you the funding with kind of strings, saying you need
to
go in that
direction.
Like
yeah. We want this because they want to be able to say, like, okay, we're the city of Montreal wants to be able to say that they're funding organizations that are reducing food waste or that are relieving food insecurity. They want specific goals, right? Because whoever's like the politicians in office, right?
Yeah.
At the given time.
Yeah, there's always a reason.
They want to have certain goals, right? They want to say, we did this, so you'll elect us next time. And anyways,
but then
that
the
kind of pisses me off. So, initial funding I got, yeah.
That was in French, PME Montréal.
PME Montréal, yeah. That was 29,000.
Fucking hell!
For
all
free.
Went in the truck.
All went what?
In the truck.
Yeah. Now we sold the truck, actually.
For loss.
For a big loss.
Oh fuck.
Yeah.
But so, how did you get that one? People were helping you then, right? You did it with
Antoine. That one I knew. Somebody from the organization, and they actually really helped me. They have a lot of
from PME
funding. Yeah.
So how was it like the very first steps? Like you started off with
we incorporated the organization, and then we went looking for funding.
Incorporating is just like a whole bunch of paperwork.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And you know, form the board of directors and all that stuff, and. Then we went to look for funding. We got funding. We got that 29,000. We got a couple other.
That is crazy money,
grand.
Man.
Yeah,
it's not 2,900. It's 29,000. How many of those bursaries they give? Just the one?
Just the one, basically, to start up. And then they have additional.
But the one group of people?
Yeah, PME Montréal.
Per year?
No, just one. I mean, to a startup, they'll give.
No, but I mean, you got one.
Yeah,
like,
I got
how
one.
Many did they give like to other people?
Oh.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. I think, I don't know how much they give away yearly, a couple hundred grand, I guess.
That's a lot of money, man. Yeah. That's a municipal, so that's probably
municipal
a tax
and,
municipal coming
yeah.
from?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. But it's kind of I don't know too much about the actual legal structure of them, but they're fine. I mean, it's public money.
Okay.
But it's cool because they're really there to support startups, but also existing companies in the social social companies,
like anyone working, yeah, but non-profits. Any stage of development,
any stage,
right?
Yeah, and they really offer like support. So they offer money, but they don't have strict guidelines on saying like you need to be this, you need to have this kind of orientation in your goals, or you need to whatever.
Okay.
They just kind of let you go do whatever you want, and they support, like they really helped me to actually make my business plan, to make financial projections. Like they gave me the documents on how to make it, and when I had questions I just asked them. And so there was not really like am I gonna get the funding or not,
right?
It was like they were helping me make the plan and decide how much funding I would ask them for.
But that's because you knew them, or that's how they work?
That's how they work, and it's also because I knew them.
Okay, but then how did you pitch it initially? So how did you, like,
I emailed the guy who I knew from, because I founded also another co-op at Vanier.
Yeah.
And when I was working with them at the co-op, we were working with this guy from PMM Montréal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started my nonprofit, I emailed him and I asked him if he could help me out. So I met with him, and then.
But then what was it? So what was like the idea of La Fourmi Verte that you had initially?
Okay, so it was really to concentrate on transforming food, because there's a lot of organizations that, I guess, some kind of concentrate on reducing food waste, but most of them, their primary goal is to reduce food insecurity. So they collect food to prevent it from being wasted, but it's because they need it for
so popular, or
yeah, whatever.
Like those guys that we went to see. What's the most, remember? And we were taking, because they had too much. And
yeah, La Corbeille,
La Corbeille in Saint Laurent.
Bordeaux, Cartierville.
So that's what they do, right? They feed people. That's the main goal.
They have like a food bank, and they have, but them, we work with them because they had a specific project, which was to recuperate food from local farmers.
Okay. Was that from the get-go? Because I remember that was...
That was, they started the project like a year, I think 2015 they started the project. So I found out about them, and when we... founded our organization, I worked with them, and there's so much wasted food,
right?
That I work with them, and whenever I kind of need food to or want to try and reduce food waste, like I just go help them.
They always have more. Wait, but then so you weren't working with them from the beginning? That wasn't in your plan?
No, they were kind of our supplier, if you want to put it that way, of food waste.
Because they had all the contacts with the local farmers. Yeah. So that's basically the, like in the commercials, right? The ugly carrots that people can't sell to IGA, Provigo, because they're too ugly.
Yeah, you can actually see pictures on our website at fondationlafourmiverte.org.
Very nice. Our official sponsors for today, La Fourmi Verte. But yeah, so you got the... No, but you got the actually, Facebook, right? The Facebook and the webpage you got?
Yeah, we have Instagram, but we're very inactive on Instagram.
Whose fault is that?
It's my fault, but we're on Facebook, but we don't really do anything. Most of the information that we have that's pertinent, that we update and everything, is on the website. So it's www.fondationlafourmiverte.org.
Okay.
And we have membership. I mean, it explains everything, what we're currently doing with our organization.
Okay.
But yeah, you see like pictures, there's pictures up there, and it is, the ugly fruits and vegetables thing, they choose a cute, ugly ones to sell as ugly ones.
Oh, so it's trendy. Don't even get the full ugly experience.
No, doesn't exist. There's a lot of reasons. Like, people think it's very simple, but it's very complicated.
Because the reason for what? For us not seeing them?
For the food waste. I mean, let's look, like, you have a carrot producer, okay? And he, when he does his harvest, he throws away 10%.
Why?
Because they don't fit into the container properly.
The container on site that he has, the farmer's container.
Okay, so the three color carrots that you buy in a styrofoam package like that.
Yeah.
They like, if they don't fit in that package.
Ah, because they're too big.
Too big, too small, or curvy.
Ah.
Or split at the end into two. All those are gone. That's about 10%.
But the farmer packages it?
Yeah, usually.
Okay.
Like in different, sometimes they'll go to a third party like packing, but usually it's the farmer.
Okay, but then you get 10% off. You shave
10% off. Right. So just start with that, okay? Forget all the rest. Then you have more. Let's say he keeps his 90%, but then it starts getting older and older, right?
Mm-hmm. On the way to the supermarket.
Yeah, or in his storage. Like carrots, for example, they last forever, but every perishable like vegetable, let's say, like has a different amount of time, but like carrots last pretty long. But eventually, like let's say after a month of his carrots in his fridge, they're still good, but they're getting a bit older. He's going to throw them away. He's not going to give them away. He's not going to discount them. And especially he won't discount them because...
Then people are just going to wait, right?
People are just going to wait and then they're going to want the discounted carrots. So if he knows that, let's say his production is whatever, right? 10,000 kilos. If he knows that he's going to sell 80% of that at his market price, he's good with that. They do their calculations during the winter.
Yeah.
They say, okay, I'm planting this many carrots, this many onions, this many eggplant. That's all I'm doing this year. If I sell, I need to sell 80% of each of them. If I do that, I'm good. So that's what they do. And they're very simple people, right? So they don't want to really save the world. They're there to do their job.
Right.
And that's it. But they do their job as a function of economic realities.
Right.
And so that's the economic reality is that. So they're fine with like giving it away, right? So when I would go... with my truck and pick it up from them.
At the farm.
They're being harvested. There's some pictures. Also more pictures in our newsletter, which is written and available to members only, which you can find out about more on our website.
Cool.
There's actually pictures in that newsletter of the sorting of these carrots at the farm by Mexican.
Oh, so they have the whole equipment. That must be pretty cool, huh?
Wait, what was I saying?
So you go there, you fill your truck, they give it to you.
They give it to you for free. If you pick it up, no problem. You take it because we're going to give it away, but we can't sell it.
That's the deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you kind of sell it though.
Okay. So me, I was an exception because I cook it. So it becomes a transformed product and then a transformed product I could sell.
Right.
So what I would now, we don't.
But that's like a gentleman's agreement, right? That you had with the guy?
Okay. Yeah.
Or a gentle lady agreement. I don't want to.
It was a gentle family agreement.
And there was two guys, so I guess.
So, yeah, that's the justification behind that. And anyways, I just wanted to sell it to be able to cover my labor costs and rent and all that stuff.
Right.
It's a nonprofit, right? So any money we make would go to funding projects and whatever. We're not, like, I don't take a salary. I've never taken a salary. We would hire employees and they would take salaries. But it's really, the structure is just to try and reduce food waste.
Yeah.
Then I guess, look, I worked in restaurants, right? So I'm not a businessman and I'm not great at it. Theoretically, I'm okay at it, but in practice, I'm not. I'm often like too emotional.
Okay. So you got,
and my dad is really good, right? Like my dad is like, no, fire him.
Right.
Yeah, but it's my friends. No, fire him. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm more like emotional when I make decisions.
Yeah. Or just like a fucking human being, right?
Yeah, but he's really cool though.
Right.
Like I think we should buy these things from him because like the guy I spoke to, the guy is like, he's really cool. You know?
But
and my dad would be like, yeah, but like how much is it? I'm I don't remember. Anyways, we got fucked over again and again and again.
By farmers?
No, not by farmers, but by everything else. By the food room. Okay, which is a company, which was basically like the girl, she went on Dragon's Den. She got a shitload of funding to do this idea.
What was that?
Which was a huge, amazing, like professional kitchen that you see in like the best hotel. Okay? Huge.
Like a building. The kitchen.
Yeah, well, she built the kitchen.
Okay.
It was in a Hunsick. So it's like, imagine the best kitchen that you could think of. Like, they have everything. They have all the best equipment for big production, you know?
But what was the business?
The business was a shared kitchen. So it, it would come with a service, co-working space type of thing. Co-working space, yeah, okay. But kitchen, but really, really top of the line professional kitchen. So you had a lot of catering companies that were there. Some hotels when they would have, you know, huge, huge demands, they would like kind of do some of their work through that kitchen.
Yeah.
And then you had us. So we were at another kitchen at the time, and then we moved there to the food room.
Yeah.
And then the next day, after I moved with my truck, okay, so we packed my entire truck, which is a lot of stuff. We moved. As I was moving there, actually, I got stopped by the police and told them off. So we got a $600 ticket.
What for the initial
arrest? That's just how everything
unraveled from there, okay? So it was like a kind of a compact, like a day of
it was crap. A day of so many things went, like I wanted to run away.
When was that? What year? What month?
2017, end of the summer-ish.
So a year and a half in?
No, 2017, so.
So half a year in?
Yeah, 8 months in.
Okay.
Something like that. August.
And now we're at 19, okay. And then, so then the truck, you moved there?
Yeah, so then we moved there. We unloaded all our stuff. Okay, we moved in. It's our new place. Like, things are tough, but they're going to go well. Then the next morning, I get a call from my employee who started earlier in the morning. The food room, they went bankrupt. And
fuck!
Yeah. So we just paid our security deposit and 2 months rent and everything because I made this deal with them, like that they're going to give me a deal on a 13-month lease if I give a bigger down payment now. And so I did it. And then they went bankrupt the next day.
So they most likely knew.
They 100% knew.
Cool move. Shout out to...
So $6,000.
Oh, wow.
That we lost. Not that we lost, that they stole from a nonprofit.
Right. Damn. So what? So
and we had no kitchen. We had nowhere to put our inventory. We lost a whole bunch of inventory.
And at that point, you were still transforming raw vegetables into pots of...
Into products.
You still do that.
We still do that. But now what we do is we'll use like other people's kitchens. So with La Corbeille... They recuperate still from local farmers during the summer. About 8 months throughout the year, they recuperate. So we'll go when we kind of need to make products for our members, we'll go there and we'll use their kitchen. I'll bring volunteers, like often kids and stuff, and friends, and we'll go there and we cook. We put some stuff in jars. We pasteurize them, whatever product we end up making. And then in addition, we'll make like big batches of preserved food, like soups or sauces or whatever that we leave for them. So it's a win-win because they have an excess of food that they recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
We go in, we kind of use some of that food. I'll bring my own spices and oils and stuff. So if I want to make something a little bit more fancy, I'll make maybe 15, 20 jars or 30 or 40, depending on how
many I need. Give us examples of stuff that you do.
Okay, so I have these... marinated eggplant, like, you know, the Italian, like, right, melanzan.
Very Italian, yeah.
And I made this hot sauce. Like, everything was free. Basically, all I pay for is like sugar, oil, a few spices. It's like so good.
And then that's for the membership people. So you do you
that's drop for the them, membership like, people. So if stuff? Someone's a member, twice a year they get a box which includes a jar and
they're perishables. A newsletter. Or I mean
they're
conserve.
Preserved foods in mason jars. And during the summer, sometimes we'll sell at a few places. But basically, my goal is not anymore, because I saw how much food is wasted, how basically impossible or really, really difficult it is to fix the problem. And so my goal has really shifted away from having a tangible impact. So like actually cooking and preserving a lot of food.
Keeping it out of the fucking waste.
Right.
Huh?
like very directly.
Right.
So it shifted away from that onto education. So I try and work with kids a lot. And this summer, actually, we have this project, which is like, which I got funding for actually from Canada Summer Jobs.
Application was in English?
It's in English and it's easy.
Yeah.
Like super easy to get.
Okay.
So I'm going to hire a bunch of kids, high school kids.
Sounds great. No, okay, that's interesting.
And they're, and they're going to, basically I'm going to teach them about food waste. They're going to cook. They're going to also develop a project or, I mean, I really want it to come from them. So I it's not.
Okay, well, you don't want to tell them what to do.
I don't want to tell them what to do. I want to be more like guiding them, but it has to be some kind of project that they're going to be able to implement throughout their school year. So it could be with their school. It could be a few of them will come from different schools. So it could be a project that they do together or like each one does in his school. It could be, for example, like get our cafeteria to compost. Like that could be his the kid's project, right? So he's going to have to meet who's the cafeteria service provider, the governing board.
Kind of a good amount of responsibility for a kid, right? To develop.
And then I'll support them, right? So I'll say, okay, well, you need to look into this. You need to meet with this person. You need to see what they say and then tell them this and do this. What if they say yes? What if they say no? What do you do?
Can you get? And if they need business advice, they call your father, right?
Yeah.
How did you find the kids? Were you just hanging out
with like, I coach in hockey. Parks
giving candies? Or?
Well, my little brother is 14.
That's true. So he's going to do it.
He's going to do it.
Cool.
If he gets the, he'll apply for the job and we'll see if I.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
Need to, yeah.
Yeah.
The five interviews and then six
exams. Phone interview.
Yeah.
Okay. And then a face-to-face interview with.
Then there's a back-to-back
interview. With the manager. And then if the manager recommends him to me, then I'll
Oh, you have a manager?
No.
Oh, that's
good. It's me too.
So how many kids? So from different school? So you're just going to wait for applications from kids? How are they going to
know? No, I'm kind of choosing the kids.
Okay. For now.
Yeah. Because, I have my brother, and then my brother has a few friends, and I tutor some kids also in math. I know a few kids from tutoring.
And I feel like it's better if they're friends because they kind of, you know,
they kind motivate of know each themselves. Other, yeah. And then I coach hockey also. So I know some kids from the 2 years now I've been coaching hockey. So
high school teams or
city? City, okay. Bantam. So I'm kind of choosing the kids. I mean, they have to be 15, so there's only some that I legally can choose that are 15. Yeah, for the funding.
Okay.
For the funding they need to be.
So the goal of that organization, the Canadian thing, is to
stimulate summer jobs for youth.
Okay, so for Canada the summer jobs. Yeah. And then you want to keep it, like, to have it over the school year afterwards. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I want them to work on the project and then take a little bit of time during the year to implement their project. But most of the work will be done during the summer.
Any other not companies, but like a group doing that kind of work with kids, like a sensibilisation?
There's La Table des Chefs.
Okay.
They do some of that kind of stuff.
Right.
They're different though. It's more complicated. It's like they have a kitchen and they offer to schools, they offer like outings basically where your school can do like a kind of field trip thing.
Okay,
and you like go like there and you learn how to cook. But me, what place. I want, yeah, to their place.
Okay, you did that at Orange Rouge.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Something like that.
But then, because I was thinking for sure there's like, because you say like how big is the waste and for sure, and especially because in the farms you see those massive amount like boom, like in the garbage. But then I remember I did a bit of research and like half of the food waste is from fucking households, right? Or I guess it's...
Well, basically the short answer is we don't know.
Right.
Because that the study where that stat comes from, basically we can't trust it.
Right.
Like it was a very small sample size and it was all the data was like extrapolated like
I guess it's literally impossible to calculate.
It's basically very very very
but hard. Then just for the sake of the argument, let's say it's like same or like it's just a big part of it, which is what you're tackling with the whole kids thing.
Yeah. And also I mean so I want to concentrate more on education generally, but more with youth, more because they listen to change, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And old people just listen to trends. And if something's trendy, they'll do it, but they're not doing it because it's wrong.
And they have their like ingrained belief that they don't want to change, right?
They've once you're like 30, like you decided everything, right? You know exactly where you stand on like everything, and you're right about it all.
Yeah.
So that it annoys me quite a lot. But kids, I like that they'll actually listen. Mm-hmm. Like, because I've done like workshops and stuff with kids, and I explain them these things, and they're like really bothered by it. Like by the fact that we waste all this food, and when you see it in front of you, hundreds of kilos of food, like throughout a day when I go to Kobe, there's kids with me and we cook stuff, and usually we transform like a couple hundred kilos of vegetables
in a day.
Together in a day into a soup or whatever, it depends, a sauce, whatever.
Okay.
And so you leave at the end of the day and you just think that all that food would have been wasted. And now instead of being wasted, it's actually going to stay with the organization. They're going to be able to give it to people who are hungry. And you actually see, like through the other side, you see people coming in who are hungry, you know. And some of them clearly have like mental health issues. Some have clearly like just generally they have trouble, right? And we're kind of part of this society that take 30 to 40% of our food and just fucking chuck it in the bin, right?
Yeah.
And
well, that's even more than society, right? It's a worldwide thing.
Like it's
like,
a worldwide thing.
Like 100, like maybe 200 years from now, they're gonna look back. They're gonna be like, look at those fucking idiots. Like half the people are dying, and the other half's obese.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Just fucking.
It makes no sense.
Yeah. And the worst is that the obese one, it's not because they eat too much of the good stuff, right?
Right, it's all the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's a few people making shit ton of money on that.
Right.
At the end of the day, it all comes down to money. That's why we waste. That's why we're obese. That's why everything. I mean, all the problems, they come back in the end to that, so.
But so, and do you see La Fourmi Verte, like, do you see it being sustainable from the membership thing at some point? Ideally, that would be like just to cover your basic costs.
Yeah, that's the goal of the membership, just to make enough money to cover our basic costs, which is basically nothing, because we're, any employees we hire, it's through subsidies like Canada Summer Jobs. So I'm not going to be hiring people really anymore unless I'm subsidized for their salary.
Because you did hire someone actual.
Yeah, I did. At a certain point, I had a chef, I had a manager, I had. We were like 6-7 employees.
Not worth it? Too much expense?
Not worth it. It could have been worth it if maybe... I mean, it could have worked. But with everything that happened, I mean, in a certain sense, you could say it was an opportunity. The getting fucked over and over and over again.
Not fucking up. Getting fucked. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it forced me to take a step back and then reevaluate things.
And maybe start being a little less, like you were saying, a little more like...
less ambitious.
No, what?
Less ambitious.
Maybe. I don't like how that sounds, though. I was going to say more like less letting your feelings drive your decision-making, right? Because it is a nonprofit, but it's a fucking business.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't want to change the kind of person I am because I need to make the business work. Whereas my dad, who's good at business, or someone who's good at business, absolutely will do that.
The
priority
like
is like how to make the business work.
Yeah.
My priority is not that. My priority is really to make the world a better place. So, I mean,
there's still a percentage of like business mindset that you have to have, like 20% maybe.
Yes.
Okay.
You could say 20%. 20-25. I do have a business mindset in some aspects. To run a big business. It's not for me.
But it's not, I'm so not big interested. Now?
Like you no, it's not so big now. Trouble. I'm fine with it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's volunteer-based. If someone wants to be involved, it's volunteer-based. You want to get involved, you can be involved. That's why I want to work with kids. Get a lot of... membership is free for kids. So kids can just go and sign up.
Okay.
And they don't get a product because it costs too much money, but they do get a newsletter.
Okay.
So we actually pay for that. for free. We give them newsletters.
You make it? You write it?
Yeah. We have also contributors.
Okay, yeah. That's cool.
And we're looking for more. So that eventually where I see things going is us having a lot of members. And just by being a member, you're kind of demonstrating something, right? You're demonstrating that you don't agree with the way that things currently are, and you know, demanding change. Like, that's what I want kids to do. I want the kids or the youth of the generation to take control of the problem.
Yeah.
And figure out ways to demand change and say, like, we're not okay with that.
No, yeah, I can see that for the, because that's another thing, right? Our generation, like, when you say, like, signing up and, like, yeah, everyone knows it's a problem. Yeah, it's a problem. If there's, like, a manif doll, people are going to go.
Yeah.
But then afterwards,
yeah.
Do they really change whatever they do at home?
Yeah.
Usually, often, sometimes, not usually really. Not. But then the kids, if you get that
thing they going. Will.
Yeah,
yeah. Sure. And they'll tell their parents, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know? Like, I remember when we were growing up, recycling was becoming more of a thing. It already was. Yeah. But our parents kind of didn't really care much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, Dad, what are you doing? That's recyclable. Oh, what? Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, for sure.
And so we're kind of there a little bit with like composting, I guess, now.
Yeah, I don't know much about the history. How long has it been around? Do you know?
What, composting?
But like, not like in the world, but like as like in the Montreal? Boxes in Montreal, yeah. Like, they're collecting and everything.
I think they said it was supposed to be implemented by, like, 2005 or something. And it's not yet implemented in every...
I thought it was done. Like, I thought everyone had
access. It's not everywhere.
They're not collecting everywhere.
They're not collecting everywhere. It's almost everywhere now.
The other thing is I saw...
But
the...
it's very bad, though.
Well,
They're composting. I wrote a thing about it in my newsletter.
Did you see Radio-Canada? They did this with the bags.
Yes. And I call, and it was super, you saw it, right?
Yeah, but explain it.
Okay, so it's a 2-minute advertisement a news study, I guess, by Radio-Canada, that they did these really quick interviews of like a few people on the street and a few workers that pick up the compost. And then they show pictures of like where the compost is being processed and everything. And then they say like half of it is thrown in the garbage, but they don't explain like if it's half, if it's before it gets to the site, if it's after, if it's during the site. Then they say something about the bags, like they ask a question to the bags about the bags. And then the person on the street says like, oh, I guess the bags are not good though. I guess the bags are not good then.
But the city was distributing the bags.
No.
To put in the compost.
It's compostable bags. It's
but
like
they're not.
They're certified. The they're certified compostable.
Right.
So, right, and then so the interviewer kind of asks a question about that. About okay, well, these bags that are certified compostable, they're good, right? And then, I mean, they do the interviews in a way that suggests that putting your compost in those bags doesn't work. That when it gets to the site, they throw them away.
That's what I understood.
Yeah. It's not clear cut. Like, I watched the video 10 times. It's not clear cut that they actually say that. But that's what the sequence of their interviews and stuff. Like, that's what it suggests. I called the city.
Okay. Wait. But before that, I feel like in that thing, that bit, there was a guy working at the thing that was saying that for the bag to work, they have to open it within 24 hours, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So then you called, you fucking...
Yeah, I called the city and I said, like, what's up, you know? And they said to call the Eco-Calcier. So I called the Eco-Calcier and they said, I don't know, we saw it too and we don't know and we're looking into it. We'll call you back. And then they called me back in a month. So they were all
kind of taken, like, by surprise by that video, the Radio-Canada thing.
Because then I said, I called the Ville de Montréal first and I said... These bags, like, can you read me the thing? She was reading me the thing from compost, right? So I'm like, okay, what is it? Like, what am I allowed putting in the compost versus not? So she's like telling me, I'm like, okay, what am I allowed putting the bags, what putting the compost in? She said, bags that are certified compostable by like one of these two companies.
Okay.
So mine were, right? And there's only one or two brands. So if it says compostable, it is. If it says like, I don't know, oxy biodegradable, it's not. It's like
a, it has to be compostable.
As compostable bag. Not it says bio, compostable. Not box oxy biodegradable. It's basically a scam thing.
Okay.
It's just plastic.
Okay. But so those bags are okay or not?
Okay, so in the rule book of Ville de Montréal, they're okay.
Okay.
But then I said, okay, but this thing from Radio-Canada really suggests like that they are okay. And says like maybe we shouldn't tie the bags or maybe we should. I don't know. Like, does it say anything about that? She said it doesn't say anything about it. So you should call your Eco-Calcier to see what they say.
Okay.
So I called them. They said, I don't know. We'll look into it. We'll call you back. And then they call me back in a month. They're like, no, it's fine. It's fine. You could just keep. Yeah, you could tie your bags. Yeah, it's fine. And I'm like, okay, but why did? Oh, no, the video was just like talking about like compost and that if you put in plastic bags, that it's not good.
That wasn't what it was talking about.
That's what they said. I know that's not what it was talking about, but that's what they
okay. said. Okay. And that's it.
That's it.
But
it's
so
the end of the story. So basically, it's a shit show.
So kind of no.
Like I'd like to actually go there and like someone should do a real study about
that. The place where it happens, right, where they dump all the stuff. The guy that's working there, he's the guy that knows, right? Or even he's not sure, maybe.
No, well, he knows what he's doing. Right?
He knows which one he's putting in the garbage, but does he know whether he should actually put that in the garbage and put that one under?
Well, he puts it in the garbage. Because he knows that if he puts it with the compost, it's gonna make it really tough for him to compost.
But so we're still not sure whether even compostable bags are okay.
They're okay. I think if you take a bag and you throw it in the compost, it will compost. So it is compostable. The problem is if you put organic materials in a compostable bag, you close it up,
right,
and you leave it in there,
right,
for 2 weeks, okay, or let's say a week during the summer. It undergoes anaerobic degradation versus aerobic
without oxygen.
So in order for compost to be effective, you need to put organic materials together, and that's why you have to mix the compost often.
Right.
It needs to undergo aerobic.
So you're using the bag, but you're never closing it.
Me, what I do is I put my stuff in a freezer in the bag, and the morning or the night before the compost truck passes, I put the bag, I don't tie the bag. I leave the bag open, I put it in my compost bin. And then the guys who pass by, I just have one bag because I live alone. And they just take the bag, they put it in their truck.
So closed bag in the heat is what
closed
you
closed bag avoid. In the heat for extended amount of time.
Because nowadays, I think a lot of people saw that video. And nowadays, I see more and more people putting the compost directly in the thing. But I mean, it's winter now, it's okay. But during the summer, man, like the thing gets disgusting and it smells.
You can't. You basically can, and the amount of things that they say are compostable, like basically anything except beef bones and like cat litter and like obvious things that are not compostable, but you can put meat, you can put fish, you can put bones if they're not beef bones.
Anything you eat, basically.
Yeah, and liquids. You can put liquids technically, right? Like a sauce that went bad, you can put it in there. So you make a big smoothie of all this stuff, and then it clearly undergoes anaerobic digestion, which is bad. So when you mix that in the compost, it doesn't make good compost.
Wait, I'm confused now. You just said it was okay, or it wasn't okay?
All it's that not stuff. Okay. No, it's not okay.
So what can you put in the compost?
You can put that stuff, but you can't put it together, close the bin, and leave it there for a week, and then try and compost it.
Yeah, unless you freeze it.
Unless you freeze it, because freezing just pauses everything.
Right,
and then by the time it thaws and it goes in the pile of compost,
but then winter again is okay because everything freezes.
Yeah.
So winter, during the summer,
you should put it in. You should make a space in your freezer and put a little container, and you put all your compost there.
Okay.
And then before they pick up the compost, you empty it in your bin. Ideally, that's what you should do. But the problem is that they implement the system, right? And why are we like sitting here asking all these stupid, obvious questions about it? Like, just don't implement the fucking system if you can't do it properly. You know what I mean? Like, don't do it in the first place. Like, there's in South Korea, they had a goal, okay? Reduce organic materials in landfills.
Yeah.
Right now, I think they're at 97% of
food waste.
Yes, 97% of their garbage is not organic. So all their organic materials, the stuff that should be composted, is separated.
Okay.
Because they set up these automatic bins where you have like garbage recycling of different things and then compost, and you have to put in your garbage in each section. So they have them outside, they have them in the cities, like close by to all homes, right. And that you have to go bring your garbage there. Okay. And then a garbage truck will come and pick it up. And you have to pay for each category.
You pay.
And in a way that they incentivize people to compost rather than throwing it away. And yeah. They incentivize people actually to use stuff.
But how?
Because like, instead of
I'm just thinking
composting.
Like they have to, because you know, humans being humans, those guys have to move and pay. How do you
motivate people to do that? You have to pay for your waste.
But then how does that work? How do you?
Well, that's the law. In order to get rid of your waste, you put your waste here. You put your waste in this big machine thing. You have to separate it.
Like away from your home.
Yeah, but it's close by to homes.
Okay. Because, I mean, I would do it, obviously, but you know that to implement it large scale, you need... So they just got the stick of the law. They're like, yes. You don't do it. That's it.
Yes.
Man, people would go crazy if you just implemented that right away. There's a cultural shift that needs... I guess it kind of happens with the kids and the younger generations, though.
But then don't do it. Then just don't do it. Yeah. Then just like... I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot better things you could do with whatever, how many billion dollars it cost you over 20 years to implement a compost system in which you probably throw away 50-60% of the stuff after driving it 100 kilometers offsite away from Montreal.
Diesel truck or whatever.
Big diesel truck. It's so stupid.
But so that box in South Korea, how does the whole anaerobic thing not
because
happen?
The compost, you have this thing that you can make, you can basically make compost right away. So it's like kind of a...
The compost happens in the box.
Yeah. You put it in and it's this thing kind of that turns and heats and turns. You can buy them for your home. They're $300.
Small.
It's a small tabletop odorless thing.
And so you can put it in your back garden right away.
Yeah. It turns your compostable materials stuff.
That's dope.
Peels and stuff into soil. After I think it's like 2-3 hours, so and it's odorless.
I'm you not, can put it I on was your gonna, countertop. That was my next question. The odor.
It's odorless.
Got the little Febreze.
You put it in. You close the top. You press go. 3 hours later, you open the thing, and it's soil.
So there's no other. So to make compost, that's you just need the food waste, and you keep it moving, and it just becomes soil. You don't have to add anything.
You have to have appropriate ratios of carbon and nitrogen.
That you artificially add in that box?
No, like carbon, nitrogen comes from like all the vegetables and stuff.
Okay.
And like carbon will come more from like leaves, paper, cardboard and stuff. So basically, I mean, if you're picking up compostable materials from like a whole city, like... It's kind of just going to even out that your ratios of carbon and nitrogen will be like pretty much stabilized. But if you make it at home and you just take, let's say, carrot peels, it's still going to make soil or some kind of dry, whatever. It's kind of like a dehydrator. I mean, or it accelerates the process of the organic material degrading and drying out.
Okay.
And so if you just use that soil, right, you take that soil from just carrot peels and you try and plant a plant in it, it's probably not going to grow very well because that soil is not diversified. Balanced. Yeah, well balanced and it's nutrients. But you could just throw it outside, right?
So $300, you can have that thing.
Yeah, you can buy a thing home, $300. So
I would be
just buy, you know, for half of the population. Like, in the other half, who cares? And just make them do it.
How much the program costs.
Or, I don't know, or right? subsidize, right?
Yeah.
Instead of spending $50 billion on, or I don't know how many but it's definitely in the billions.
And that's the other thing, though. The guy I had last time at the podcast, he was saying he works for that think tank. And he was, part of his job is trying to get those kind of information because they're against all public investment. It's a libertarian type of thing. Okay. And he was saying very often he was doing accès à l'information, right? Through legal channels, they have to give you the info. And he was saying, man, they do everything for you not to have it. Because it's probably fucking outrageous, like you said, like billions of dollars and like...
Yeah, that's just being...
But then so many jobs, right? Because that's the thing, though. Even if it comes out, then you cut that thing. How many jobs depends on it? Are people going to come out in the street? I mean, I'm with you, but you know, it's very fucking complicated. But, dude, that thing, like, I'd be curious about the economics of having that box, having the compost, being able to grow your thing. You probably pay it back within a few years because you save so much on food. I don't know, but.
It'd be interesting. Yeah. Huh. Anyways, so the other thing actually that we concentrate now mostly on, there's education and also policy change. That's what I was telling you about a little bit before, is that I'm part of a newly formed food policy council. In French, it's called... Oh, they have so many names. Conseil du système alimentaire montréalais.
So it's Montreal-wide.
Okay, technically, there's like no legal structure.
Okay.
But it's supported by everyone. There's a representative from the city on there.
Okay.
There's someone from Direction de la Santé Publique, someone from MAPAC, Recy Québec, universities, all over. So anyone who is on that board, like anyone who has like legitimate influence on the
food
system is on that board.
Yeah.
The goal of the board is to, I mean, it started less than a year ago, so we don't have a strategic plan
yet. Right.
I mean, it's one of our first things to do, but generally the goal is to be able to have a board full. There's about 20 experts who make up the board, and we're supposed to together influence political action, political decisions that should be taken in order to improve the système alimentaire.
And how does that work? How you get people to listen?
Well,
that's what you get.
Well, I mean, we have people that work for the city, right?
That kind of
helps. On our board. Yeah. So then together we make like little subcommittees, you know, and we'll say, and maybe we'll work on a certain project, like let's say food waste, for example, right? We could say, okay, well, we're going to look into food waste. So we have people that do studies. We have, and it's funded by Centraide, Ville de Montréal, a whole bunch of organizations.
And have you tried to see what the thoughts are on the whole compost mess? Maybe that'd be a good project to just clean that mess.
We haven't talked about that.
Okay. I guess there's so many fucking...
There's, I mean, first we need to make a... Yeah, the first few meetings we had, we've just kind of been looking at each other a little bit and trying to get to know each other, trying to figure out how we're going to divide each other into...
Right.
So we divided basically into four general groups. Like one food insecurity, one is... I don't remember them all, but the other one is like ecological footprint of the système alimentaire.
Okay.
And whatever, there's two other ones.
And that's households and private and companies and restaurants, everything? Or...
Yeah.
Okay.
The system.
Right.
So how can we study the system and propose policy changes to positively impact the system? Like generally that's the goal of it.
Okay.
And it's not just some organization that someone puts together and says, I'm going to invite my friends. And yeah, you can write whatever goals you have, right? But unless you have like legitimate backing by the city.
Why?
And all the important institutions like MAPAC and Santé Publique and all this...
Yeah.
Then well, you're basically got
the foot in the legislative
in
process
every door.
Yeah.
Every door we want.
Yeah.
And if there's rules from MAPAC that need to be changed, for example, they'll be changed.
Right.
You know, it's not like me. Let's say I would do this kind of initiative on my own through that FOMI, and I would say like, "Hi, my name's Andrew, like from FOMI. Hi, MAPAC. Like, do you want to maybe change this rule? It would be, I think, really nice." Then they would just never answer me.
But so how did you get on that thing board?
I applied to the board and I got it.
They were open? You just email, cold call?
It was open. There was an appel de candidature.
Okay.
Which was launched, I don't know, a year ago or something.
Damn.
And they did a research and all the people that applied. And they tried going after a few people who wanted to be part of it also.
Okay.
And... So that's kind of the other aspect that we concentrate. So now we concentrate on education, political influence. Because I think that that's two avenues that we could have a lot of impact in.
Right.
That could actually positively impact the situation. Whereas before, I had no website, I had no Facebook, no social media. No one knew about me except my mom and dad and friends.
Yeah.
And I'm cooking a shit ton of food. Like, I'm saving a shit ton of food. Whereas now I save way less food. But more people know about it. More people know about the project and stuff. Right. So that's kind of the trade-off. But even though I was cooking so much food, it was costing me so much money, so it was not really sustainable.
Right.
And it's still not that much compared to how much you're wasting.
Right.
Like, even if it's, I think our first year we did like 100 tons or something that we transformed, which is quite a lot.
Right.
But it's compared to...
It's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's
And in terms of like legislation and stuff, it's because you have, there's more and more examples coming from a whole bunch of countries now, right? The one example
we have is France, who makes it
illegal to waste for supermarkets or whatever.
Exactly.
Those are pretty low-hanging fruits that, like, there's not much arguments against it,
I know.
Yeah.
Exactly. We just need to copy what other people are doing. Right. Like, we're so backwards here in North America.
In general,
We're 10 years back, easily, from a lot of European countries. Like, yeah.
Do you have, like, crazy statistics or something?
No, I'm not really.
With the statistics?
I'm good. No. I'm good with numbers, but not in that way. But, no, I just know that. I mean, I know, in France, what they did is they made it illegal. I think if you have a square footed, if you serve food in a place which has, like, square feet of more than, like, 400 square meters, which is pretty small.
Okay.
You sell food in one way or another, you're not allowed to throw away food. Basically, you have to donate it.
Okay. So they don't put like anything like a collection or whatever. They let people figure it out. They're just saying
they let people figure it out, but they have organizations which are supported by the government which help with the communication between people who generate waste and people who could use the waste. And they're not really, it's a law, but it's not there to give people fines. Like the goal of the law is not just to create some law where you can fine people
and steal their money.
It's to donate. Because here you have people you have restaurants or supermarkets which fill up their bins. And there's like a community organization, maybe 100, 200 meters away. Or even a few kilometers away, who would gladly drive their truck, you know, every Thursday at 6 p.m., for example, fill up their truck with food and bring it back so that they can give it to their members. Because you have all these organizations which always say they're lacking food. But
you have to make sure, though, that so I'm sure in France they did like some in the law it says that only something like only nonprofit can collect the whole thing, because that's what I'm seeing is like it's not very profitable to be there, right? So that's why the French government wanted to help the people collecting the money,
right?
But even then I like the problem I can see is that there's not going to be enough people like you to collect food because there's no money, there's not much money to be made, right?
Yeah.
But then at the same time you can't
sell it.
Exactly, because then it becomes like it doesn't make sense. No,
it doesn't make any sense.
So how is that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who are food insecure.
Right.
And right now, I mean, I don't know. We don't really have that problem. They didn't really talk about that in France. It seems like they still have a lot of people who are food insecure and they still need a lot of help. A lot of donations of
donations,
food.
So, government subsidies.
I mean, they're not really there. I guess if we would ever be in that situation, it would be a good problem
right.
to have.
Yeah.
That you have too much food being donated.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right, man. Do you have a... Why don't you fucking blow my mind with some mathematical theorem? You had it in your pocket. He had it in his pocket. He was going to say... You were going to say? I had it in my mind. I was waiting for that part.
Did you see my new tattoo?
That's the one, the 163.
I put it on Instagram. Yeah,
163. Why is that?
I'm going to explain it to you.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Did you do that over Christmas?
No, I just... I did it last week.
Okay.
A week and a half ago.
Okay.
163.
Yeah.
It's a special number.
Okay.
They're all special.
Right.
But it's a little bit more special.
Okay. It's specialer.
It's specialer, as we say. So I got a tattoo of it on my elbow.
Okay.
On my tricep.
And now you're going to explain how
special. Now I'm going to explain a few reasons about why 163 is special.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
And I tried explaining it to like my mom, my dad, my grandmother, and my sister, and no one understands what I'm saying. So
fuck. Well, no pressure.
We'll do our best.
Yeah.
I think you'll be able to pretty much understand it.
Okay.
It's not that complicated. I know, but we can't, because people who are listening don't, they can't see, so I can't write things down. I just need to explain.
That's for me.
I'm going to generally explain. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can explain more afterwards if you want. First, I'll give you a few weird facts, okay? And then I'll give you the big property at the end.
Okay.
So if you take, if you take 2 to the power 9 and divide it by 163, you get a number that's really, really close to pi.
Okay. It's not bad. That's a good
not
start.
Not bad. It's a good start.
How many decimals does it go?
Like 3 or 4. It's not that bad. It's not
1416 kind of thing?
Yeah. So 1411.
Hmm.
If you take 163 divided by 60,
yeah,
you get a number that's close to E.
Okay.
You know E.
And is it very rare that a number is close to those?
I didn't try them all.
I'll take your word for it. Okay, number 3.
163 is a strictly non-palindromic number.
That will that require means, some, yeah.
You know you can write numbers in a different base?
Yes.
Okay. If anyone of our listeners doesn't know that, you could Google it. It's pretty simple. It's just basically expressing a number using a different amount of digits. We use
10 is what?
Yeah. So we do. Well,
usually
now.
Yeah.
Today.
Huh.
Yeah.
We used to.
Oh yeah. There was a big fight between 10 and 12.
I remember you telling.
It should have been 12.
The fingers were the only reason for the 10.
The finger. That's the reason we use 10 digits to count.
12.
But other than that, there's no good reason to be using 10.
2, 3, 4, 6. That doesn't.
But 12. 12 has more divisors, right. So it would make arithmetic easier. But technically, you could use any base you want.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's so many examples, like when we count minutes, we use base 60. When we count time, we use base 60. Calendar is base 12. There's eggs, a lot of things.
Base 12.
Eggs base 12, that dozens and stuff. There's a lot of examples if you look around where we still will use base 12.
And there's probably a rational, real world reason for those.
Yeah,
right?
That it would make arithmetic a lot easier because 12 has more divisors. So you get less decimals and stuff. I mean, it's not really a big deal.
Still. But it's interesting. It would have been crazy to think that 12, if 12 were the...
Yeah.
We'd probably have a sixth finger, like a prosthetic. Just to...
No, well, they say you could count using, you know, each finger. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
So you get to 12 with this, right?
Yeah.
Ah, fucking hell.
Because each of your 4 fingers, they have 3, like, sections to it.
Was that how those guys, the proponents of that, were doing?
The guys who use 12, base 12, if they would count like that, maybe.
Yeah,
yeah, when you're teaching kids, you go, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay, but so...
Anyways, if you write 163 using any base. Between any base less than 163, because you can't write something like
that. Okay.
It's non-palindromic. So... Palindrome means you can read it like frontwards or backwards, and it's the same thing.
So it's not like that.
It's not like that for any base between 0 and 160. Between 1 and 160.
So any
base. I guess not including 1, because 1 is just like ones.
Yeah, but then so could, and that's assuming that other numbers, it would happen at some point.
It does, yeah, often.
Is it like a statistical thing?
It's
like,
just a thing. I don't know. I didn't really look into it that much.
Okay.
Okay, so this one's actually more important. You know Ramanujan?
Nope.
Oh, they made a movie about him. It's called...
Mathematician?
Yeah, mathematician. Amateur mathematician from India. The movie's called A Man Who Knew Infinity.
Okay.
He's probably one of the best like mathematicians, like you would have heard of him, of like all time, if he was born like not in India.
Okay.
And if he didn't die, I think he died, he was like 28 or something, or 26.
And got famous after dying, I
guess? No, he was famous even before he died. Just because he invented a whole bunch of shit independently in India with a very, very limited amount of resources. Mostly with using numbers and like infinite sums and a whole bunch of identities, a whole bunch of approximations for prime numbers, approximations for irrational numbers like pi and e, which is like really big deal because back then they didn't have calculators. So irrational numbers were like not well understood at all.
What?
And you couldn't just put it in a computer and say, okay, tell me the first 1,000 decimal places of this irrational number. You couldn't. You had to use like old school techniques.
And he did that.
Well, he came up with a lot of approximations and stuff and ways that you could get very good approximation of irrational numbers very, very quickly by adding together like 10 terms instead of having to add together like 500 terms to get an approximation for the same number.
Okay.
Like pi, for example. Anyways.
So that guy?
So he found that if you take e to the power of pi times the square root of 163, square root of 163
e to the power of
pi times the square root of 163,
okay,
you get a whole number. You get a number that's really, really, really close to a whole number.
Okay.
And he convinced everyone that it was a whole number because it's so close. It's 12 nines after the decimal, so it's like some big whole number, 0.9999999. 12 nines before it's not
a number. Let's just e to the pi times
e to the pi times the square root of 163.
Okay, in the exponent is the square root of 163.
The
square root
is in the exponent.
That's random.
Yeah. And that's really weird because e and pi are both irrational numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And he convinced everyone, so they thought he was like some...
And he would have like broken physics if it were true or something like that?
No, it just would have been a really, really big deal.
Because it changed.
So that they thought like 163 is like some kind of magic number.
And then they ended up being like, oof,
well, it's, idiot. It's still kind of weird that it's like really close. So yeah. Like some construction of 163 can get you really close to a whole number, really close to pi, really close to e. So somehow it's like related to these very fundamental, important numbers, right? Like a whole number is like kind of a multiple of one, you can see it. So it's like a really important number. So it's like...
And do you see 163 when you walk in the street?
When I dream?
Is 163 with us right now?
It talks to me sometimes. Okay, now the big one, okay.
Oh, there's like a problem.
No, the big...
Reason?
Yeah. The big property, the very important property that it has. Okay, so if you have... Okay. Imaginary numbers. Do you know imaginary numbers?
Not familiar, no.
Okay, so that's when you allow, like, okay, you put a negative number inside a square root.
That's
basically mistake. That's yes, so that's your brainwash talking. That it's a mistake.
Okay.
If you do that, it's not a real number.
Fair.
Okay, so the real numbers are all the numbers you can imagine if you draw a number line.
Yeah.
You put zero at the middle, and you just kind of imagine all the numbers like increasing or decreasing from positive, negative, infinity. Yeah. If you take any of those numbers and you multiply it by itself, you're going to get a positive number.
Yes.
But if you invent a new number, okay, I'm going to invent it right now. I'm going to call it number.
Okay.
And it's going to be equal to square root of minus 163.
Okay.
And if I take this number and I multiply it by itself, I'm going to get negative 163. Because if you have square root of negative 163 times square root of negative 163, you get negative 163.
Because the square root cancels
out. It's a square root of the square of a number, basically.
Right.
So you get a negative number. But you just said that if you square two numbers... I just said that if you square two numbers, two real numbers, you only get a positive number all the time. But I just invented a new number that such that if you square it, it's negative. And that's what is called imaginary numbers.
Okay, But is there a rule that says that because it goes one way, is it like a symmetric operation? Does it have to be? It's your number. You just do whatever you fucking want. Because
you borrow all the same rules from those other that guys. You're already brainwashed. That we're already brainwashed with.
Okay.
So if you do that, you can define a new number. So the default imaginary number is square root of -1, which people call I.
Okay.
So, but the interesting thing or the cool thing is that. So let's say you do this with I. Okay, you have square root of -1. Then you can divide. You can find a whole set of numbers which you didn't have before, by taking a real part and an imaginary part. So, okay. Like for example, 3 + 2i. Okay, you have 3 real numbers mm-hmm. plus 2i. So you have like 2 imaginary. So your imaginary part is 2 and your real part is 3.
Mm-hmm.
That's an imaginary number because it's like basically you have a sum of the real part and an imaginary part. And then this whole set of taking like a plus bi. Right. Basically, right? Where A and B vary through the real numbers.
Yeah.
That gives you a whole space of numbers, which include all the real numbers, but also include all the imaginary numbers. Or okay. They're called also complex numbers sometimes.
Okay.
It's a set. This is like analogous to thinking of all the integers. So like mm-hmm. positive and negative whole numbers. And then considering all of the real numbers. And saying that all the integers are part of the real numbers, but it's a subset. So the real numbers are a subset of the complex numbers.
Just like
they just have zero imaginary part.
Wait, complex meaning imaginary, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you do that, it turns out it's actually very, very important and describes a lot of physical realities of our universe, and that's why people care about imaginary numbers, because any guy could just go and say I'm gonna invent a new number and give it this weird stupid property.
So it's a thing, right?
it
didn't just make
a
it
big
up.
Thing
yeah it's a thing
it's a big thing
complex like university numbers, course type of thing
high school they should be talking about it in high school honestly dude it's complex numbers like it's really not that complicated.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, okay so then
this space of numbers will have properties, yes. Certain properties. Now I'm going to give you an example of a property, okay, that we have in the integers, is that you have unique factorization. And what that means is that you can take any number which is not a prime number, like 12, for example, or 20 or 18, and you can break it down into a product of prime numbers. So if you take 12, you can break it down in 2 times 2 times 3. They make you do this in high school.
Yeah.
18 is 2 times 3 times 3. 20 is 2 times 2 times 5.
And all that's inherited from the real subset.
This is just a property of integers.
Right.
It's just a property they have.
Okay.
There's a proof for it. And it's something they brainwash all of us with at school. Like, this is a fact. But in different space, in different groups, considering different groups of numbers, this is not always the case.
Okay.
That you can break.